Polls on today, June 3rd. Welcome to the House Committee on Rules. We have a number of members that are here to talk about some bills, so I am going to call you up as quickly as possible. But starting with, we're going to open up a work session on House Bill 2274. Erin, will you describe the message? Representative McEwen, Representative Davis.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2274. I will direct your attention to the Dash A4 amendment. It replaces the original measure, changes name of Multimodal Transportation Fund to Connect Oregon Fund, revises definition of transportation project for purposes of fund to include marine projects, and to clarify, the definition does not include operating costs or purchase of vehicles, deletes provisions relating to loans made from fund, increases requirement for local project funding from 20% to 30% of project cost, includes as part of project selection criteria whether project has useful life expectancy that offers maximum benefit to state, prohibits director of Oregon Department of Transportation from appointing member of final project review committee who represents entity that has application under consideration by committee or direct financial interest in application under review. There's an emergency clause on the Dash 4 amendment. It comes to you with no revenue impact. A fiscal impact statement was issued, as if you adopt the Dash 4 amendment, the measure will need to go to Ways and Means.
With that, representatives.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Representative Davis and I are very happy to be here. I'm Catty McEwen. I represent House District 9 down on the South Coast. And Madam Chair, I am receiving direction from Vice Chair Gilliam, so I will move microphone. I'm going to start again. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Catty McEwen. I represent House District 9 down on the South Coast, and I'm very happy to be here to talk about House Bill 2274-4, the Connect Oregon Bill. As your very able staff just mentioned, there are some minor tweaks to a very important program that has been in place for quite some time now. The Connect Oregon program is of tremendous value to the non-highway modes of transportation that we find need infrastructure investment across the state. As you all know, gas taxes only pay for highway investment. We have marine, rail, transit, aviation, and bike ped projects across the state that we are very happy can be funded by Connect Oregon dollars. We brought together a work group in the sixth iteration of Connect Oregon to look at where the program started and where the program is right now and where we think the program might want to go. And out of a work group which consisted of the chairs of both of the transportation committees in the House and the Senate, the co-chairs of the Ways and Means Sub for Transportation, and a representative from the House and the Senate, just to look at the legislation, we made a few minor tweaks that consist of changing the definition of a transportation project. We had failed to add marine to that definition, so we added marine. We eliminated loans from the program. We found that they are not very effective. People don't apply for very good reason, and grants seem to be more productive in getting transportation projects that are meaningful across the state in a region in a statewide way to actually be applied for and to be constructed. We changed, after a lot of discussion, the amount of money that a project needs to bring to the table as a match from 20% to 30%. We changed some language that dealt with the concept of durability of projects. We were finding that as bonding capacity is normally a couple of decades, we were having some projects come through that did not demonstrate that there was a strong durability factor. So we tightened that language up a little bit without being too conscriptive. We also added some language that directs the director of ODOT, when he's putting together the final review committee, to consider people who are coming up out of the local area commissions on transportation, what projects they actually had up for consideration. So we had an issue that we wanted to address to make sure it's a very clean process and eliminate conflicts of interest. We added an emergency clause to put it into effect. And we're very pleased with the outcome. We had a hearing on this on Monday with all of the modes of transportation in the room, talking about not only the value of the program in its entirety, but what these changes to the statute represent. And we had a good hearing. People were pleased, and we're ready to bring this forward for your consideration. Hope you'll consider the Dash 4 amendment and adopt the bill.
Thank you. And great. Representative Davis
was part of our committee also and would like to join us.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. State Representative John Davis from House District 26. I'm here to reiterate that we had a very bipartisan and constructive process as part of the work group and part of the Transportation Committee with a great hearing on Monday with members from across the board, the bicycle, the pedestrian, the rail, marine, aviation modes, basically every mode, including cars and trucks, who expressed their strong support for the continuation of Connect Oregon. I can tell you that having been at transportation conferences throughout the country, Oregon's efforts in Connect Oregon have been seen as really groundbreaking. The fact that we would invest our lottery bond funding in economic development and multimodal investment, total in the tune of $370 million over Connect Oregon 1 through 5, is unique around the country. There's broad support for continuing Connect 6, and the proposal before you, although it's not the direct funding proposal, makes some programmatic changes that really tighten up the program, make sure taxpayer dollars are used most wisely, and make sure the best projects really rise to the top, being agnostic as to the mode that gets funded, putting all modes on an equal footing to be able to receive funds. So I offer my support and would ask for yours. Thank you.
Excellent. Any questions from yes, Representative Kenema.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In looking at this, I see that it was sent unanimously to rules, but sent unanimously without recommendation.
Chair Hoyle, Representative Kenemer, I think you'll find that what was sent to rules was a placeholder bill. This is a gut and stuff of an amendment. So what we sent was we sent a bill down that had the purpose of being a placeholder so we could go through this process, bring the amendment, and gut and stuff the bill. So that's what you're seeing.
Any other questions? Yes.
Just to follow up on that. So the gut and stuff was put together by whom then?
What this bill consists of is the language that's in statute currently from the prior session. That is the language that puts the Connect Oregon program into place. So we took the language from the prior session, made these minor amendments to it, and then are bringing that forward as Connect Oregon 6. So we took the Connect Oregon 5 language and amended it, and bringing that now as the Connect Oregon 6 program bill.
And basically, this covers all transportation except roads.
This covers all modes except those covered by the highway gas tax, correct. So it is not used for bridges. It's not used for pavement. It's not used for culverts or anything that's paid for by a highway gas tax, because we have no consistent current source of funding or revenue that is dedicated to any modes except highway.
Actually, gas tax is allocated to bicycle paths and some other activities, so that's not
in a very limited way. And in the last session, the wisdom of this body determined that bicycle and pedestrian modes were added to the Connect Oregon program. They had not been there in the past. In fact, the Connect Oregon program did not include bike ped. It included transit, but not bike ped. So in the last session, it was the wisdom of this body that bike and pedestrian be added to this program.
Any other questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Davis, why do you believe that a greater power cannot be proven, such as God?
Thank you, Chair Hoyle. Representative Gilliam, I'm just going to use the word germaneness.
Thank you so much for using that word. That is a fantastic word.
You said
word.
You were agnostic.
Yes, he did.
Madam Chair.
Germaneness.
I move to adopt the -4 amendment to House Bill 2274.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved to adopt the -4 amendments to House Bill 2274. Is there discussion? Is there objection? If not, the motion passes.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2274 with the due pass as just amended recommendation. And that the measure be referred to Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved House Bill 2274 with a due pass as just amended recommendation and the measure be referred to Ways and Means. Is there discussion? Is there objection?
I plan to be a no vote.
Okay, please call the roll, Zoe.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Kenemer.
No.
Representative McLean.
Aye.
Representative Nose.
Aye.
Representative Rayfield.
Yes.
Representative Wilson.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
Chair Hoyle.
Aye. With that, the motion passes and close the work session on House Bill 2274. With that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2936. Erin, will you describe the measure? Representative Stark.
Yes, Madam Chairman of the Committee, House Bill 2936 extends criminal and civil immunity, sobering facilities for actions taken in good faith with probable cause without malice. I will direct your attention to the A-19 Amendment. The A-19 Amendment defines police officer, defines sobering facility as facility that operates for purpose of providing individuals who are acutely intoxicated, safe, clean, and supervised environment until person is no longer intoxicated, contracts with or affiliated with treatment program or provider approved by the Oregon Health Authority to provide addiction treatment, has adopted a comprehensive written policies and procedures incorporating best practices for safety of intoxicated persons, employees, and volunteers at a facility, and is registered with Oregon Health Authority. It requires the Oregon Health Authority to establish registry of sobering facilities, specify the content of written requirements for registration, permits the authority to only register a sobering facility that is operating when this measure becomes effective and who submits written requests by December 31st of 2015. After January 1, 2016, the Oregon Health Authority may accept written requests for sobering facilities not operating when the measure became effective, but may not register more than 3 of these new sobering facilities. Requires Oregon Health Authority to report to each regular legislative assembly beginning in 2017 on sobering facilities registered with the authority. Specifies information to be included in a report, extends civil and criminal immunity to treatment facility or treatment staff. Sobering facility registered with the Oregon Health Authority before January 1, 2016, or sobering facility staff for actions taken in good faith with probable cause without malice. This measure has no revenue, minimal fiscal impact, Madam Chair, but this measure does need to go to Ways and Means with the adoption of the -A-19 amendment.
Representative.
Wow, that almost described it itself. So, Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dwayne Stark, State Representative, House District 4 in Southern Oregon. And this bill has been quite the educational process for me. Probably the most valuable thing I've learned, apart from a first-year law degree, is that when a former legislator, namely Wally Hicks, asks you to carry a simple three-word bill for him, that's a committee bill, run. 5 months later and hundreds of conversations later and 19 amendments later, here we are. So I'm going to outline for you as briefly as possible the problem that we're facing, why even have a bill like this, the solution that we're trying to deal with in the counties, and then some of the complications, which is why we ended up with 19 amendments. I'll go as quickly as possible. But in short, the problem is right now, if a police officer comes upon someone who is acutely intoxicated to the extent that they are a danger to self or others, because they can no longer make a rational decision. By law, that police officer actually has an obligation to do something with that individual. Current laws allow them to take them to detox facilities or sober centers that are connected to those detox facilities, or take them to the hospital, or if those aren't available, take them to a jail. Now, one of the issues is that in many of the counties, jail space is limited, and detox centers or treatment facilities are non-existent. And so in an attempt to resolve this problem, many counties are proposing, or a few counties have proposed, what's considered a standalone sober facility. Again, how it would work right now, like in Josephine County where this bill originated, is that somebody, you know, police officer would pick somebody up who's acutely intoxicated, cannot make rational decisions, and would take them, most likely, since there's no jail space, to the hospital. Someone like my wife, who would work crisis at the hospital, would get called in to do a mental health evaluation on this person. But because they are acutely intoxicated, their blood tox levels are at a level that they cannot be evaluated. And so we tie up all these hospital resources, and the mental health professionals sit there and wait, their blood tox levels come down, and then they attempt to do this evaluation. And the majority of the time, if they were there because they were acutely intoxicated, at that point they are no longer a danger to self or others. So it's a very expensive way of helping this community. So enter the proposal of sober facilities. Right now there are three in existence that we know of in Oregon, but all of them are attached to a treatment facility. And one of the catches with this is many counties said, hey, let's give an opportunity for people to sober up, and if there's still a danger, then we can refer them on to treatment. If they are not, we can just have them go home. Great. Enter the issue here. So this is where we thought it was a three-word change, where we can add in the words and sober facility as a location that you could take someone. Well, as I've learned all about regulation now with addictions and mental health and the Oregon Health Authority and so forth, with great regulation comes great legal protections, such as civil and criminal liability protections for those sober or for the treatment facilities. Now, if you lessen those regulations, it makes sense that you would also lessen those protections. Hence, the division in this bill. So what this bill now proposes to do is have a slightly lesser legal immunity protection, legal liability protection, for those standalone sober facilities, which they need some sort of protection in order to operate and get proper insurance and so forth. So I'm going to walk you through quickly the bill, because there are many components of the bill. Again, this is just a very quick walkthrough. Page 2 defines what a police officer is. Now, believe it or not, that was a last-minute adjustment that we made, which we are going to have to make one final adjustment in Ways and Means that we expect to be a one-sentence type adjustment. Unfortunately, when we defined police officer, we somehow input the word full-time, employed full-time. Some police officers are not employed full-time. And we also said by the city or county, and we neglected to put in Oregon State Police. So we expect one and only final adjustment in Ways and Means of including fixing those two portions, removing the full-time and adding in the Oregon State Police. So we define what a sober facility is, which is a place for the purpose of providing to individuals who are acutely intoxicated a safe, clean, and supervised environment until the individuals are no longer acutely intoxicated. Then it goes on to talk about the importance of affiliating these standalones and having them in contract with the treatment programs that are heavily regulated, and the importance of having the two of them work together to come up with the best practices for these facilities. So that's the beginning of page 3. As you go down, then it talks about a registry. We didn't want to lessen the protections for our existing sober centers, and so we decided what we would do is go ahead and grandfather in the current sober facilities that are a functioning, managed part of the current treatment programs that are in existence, so that we would go ahead and have them registered. They would have the protections that they currently receive, and then the new standalones that would be created in the future would have a slightly lesser protection, basically taking from the word malice down to a gross negligence. Some of you can relate to what that's all about. Thank you for the help with the law degree on that. So that's page 2. On the process for these sober centers, the existing ones and the new ones to become registered. Then you come down middle of page 4 under section 2, subsection 7, the importance of having a legislative report back, or AMH is going to report back to the legislature on, are these things working? Is this relationship, these contracting affiliates, are these best practices, are they working the way that we think that they're going to work? If they're not, we'll intervene at that point. But if they are, great. And so we have it set up so there can be report backs. Then the next section 3, bottom of page 4, gets into the legalities of the police officer on where they can, when they pick somebody up who's acutely intoxicated, danger to self or others, where they can take them. Home, but if they can't make a rational decision, they can take them to a treatment facility or a sober facility, Or if those don't exist, they can take them to jail if there's jail space. So most of that's current law, but we've added in and kind of worked on the wording a little bit to include sober facility. Then we move on to page 5, the actual treatment intake process. So if a police officer says, yes, this person is so intoxicated that they're a danger to self and others, and then he decides to take them to a treatment facility, we talk about what that intake is. If he or she decides to take them to a sober facility, we talk about what that intake process is. And then we move on to talk about if he decides to take them home. Page 6, at the top of it, talks about record keeping. Some people were concerned with the confidentiality part of this. Standard HIPAA-type record keeping, but it's outlined there. And then we get into the final and what originated the bill is the immunity process protections. In Section 4 on page 6, where, again, the current immunity would apply, the malice level of immunity would apply to our existing sober facilities. And then for any new standalone facilities that get registered after January 2016, those ones, the immunity, lesser regulation, lesser protection. So we've decreased the immunity protections down to a gross negligence. That is it in as short as I can imagine trying to do it. A ton of people have worked really hard on this. I appreciate them. Broad support at this point. We didn't start out that way, but broad support. We have Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, Chief of Police, Oregon Trial Lawyers. Art Towers is here if anyone wants to double check with them that, yes, they are supportive of this bill at this point. Addictions and Mental Health. I'm sure I'm missing some. I mean, Chris Mason at the Moore Center has worked on this. Kathy Kim and College of Emergency Physicians. Kevin Campbell, Alex Kyler. I mean, the list goes on and on and on of the number of people who have worked on this. We believe that we have it at a point that all parties are satisfied, as well as they're going to be for all of them to be satisfied. So at that, I will attempt to take questions.
Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I suspect it's covered in here, and I simply am not seeing it. It's not clear, at least to my reading, that a sobering facility would have the access to the medical staff necessary to assist in detox of a seriously intoxicated person on barbiturates or alcohol. Of course, absolutely essential for a successful detox without potential brain damage and other organ damage. I assume that it's actually in the definition here somewhere. I just don't see it.
Well, no, you make, Madam Chair, Rep. Barnhart, you make a valid point that we discussed in depth with AMH. Again, AMH saying that there isn't anything to regulate here because so if you read through it, you'll see that they have to be released and moved on from the sober center within 24 hours. And your true detox levels are going to happen after that. So so they will be working with the detox centers or the treatment facilities or program providers that they're working with in consultation to come up with the best practices and signs of should they refer them on or should they keep them there. So sober facilities are not detox centers, and so be clear of that, so they don't need the same medical staff that.
First of all, I just want to thank you for bringing this forward. I also want to thank Representative Wilson, your staff, and the work that went into getting this. The key thing is that we have some of our counties and some of our rural counties and certainly timber-dependent counties that don't have the resources to have the facilities to help people who are inebriated, a danger to themselves and others, and without these places, which are, you know, privately funded, there would be no place for these people to go. So they could freeze to death, they could be hurt, they could be injured, they would be vulnerable, or they end up in jail, or they end up in the emergency room, again, costing more money. So this really is something that came out of a real need, and I want to thank you for working so hard. I know it would have been easy to walk away because this was not easy, and also thank the advocates everyone involved. This was quite a lift, but I know that you're committed to getting this passed. Let you know that we are as well. This is really important. This will save lives in a place where they don't have the infrastructure and they don't have the resources to care for people who really, really are vulnerable. So as you said, there's a plan to make a few slight adjustments in ways and means that you mentioned just to Any other adjustments other than that will blow apart a really carefully considered and negotiated deal that will actually get people help where they need it. So I'm hoping that that does not happen in Ways and Means. And with that, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to simply note thanks for the answer to my question, because it helps place the sobering facility in the context of the treatment continuum.
Correct.
Which, of course, is critically important. I would second the comments made by the Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And there will be a medical, a physician or a medical director that will work on getting best practices, although they won't necessarily have someone there. But thank you. And Representative Wilson.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. I appreciate the effort of everyone in this whole process. It has been a Herculean effort. I want to thank Representative Stark's staff for working so hard on this as well. Don did a wonderful job with that. And I really want to thank you, Madam Chair, for the work that you did, because as you have not advertised, but I certainly will for you, you kind of lowered the blade and cleared the road for us a couple of times when we really needed the help. And so thank you very much for all you did. And frankly, if I get an opportunity to be involved in the naming of this facility, if I can't work Hoyle in there somehow, there's something wrong.
According to Hoyle.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Madam last Chair, words before we go.
To add one final thing is you may see us back in a few years. And the reason you may see us back is we wanted to tiptoe into these waters. And so we couldn't do a normal pilot where something sunsets, because people will spend millions of dollars creating these, and they need to know that these protections will be ongoing. So how we tiptoed in is we are allowing three counties to register, three new sober centers to become registered in the upcoming years. And then to add any more beyond that would be kind of contingent upon the AMH report back, and the legislature would have to intervene and open it up to include any more at that point. So. Again,
fantastic. With that, I would accept a motion.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the -A19 amendment to House Bill 2936.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved to adopt the -A19 amendments to House Bill 2936. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Hearing none, the motion passes.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2936 with a due pass as amended recommendation, and the measure be referred to Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved House Bill 2936 with a due pass as amended recommendation and referred to Ways and Means. Is there discussion? Is there objection? If not, motion passes. Close the work session on House Bill 2936. It's not agnostic at all. He's a pastor. And with that, we will now, open up SCR 2 and public hearing and a work session. Representative Boone, Aaron, will you describe the measure?
And Madam Chairman of the Committee, SCR 2 is a memorial to honor Bud Ginger.
Madam Chair, Committee, Deborah Boone, House District 32, for the record. Here today to introduce SCR 2, memorial for Leonard Bud Ginger. He's a community champion. Bud was born in Tillamook to a farming family. He graduated with a degree in dairy management from Oregon State University, where he met Helen Hume, his wife of 55 years. Bud competed on the wrestling team, which won three consecutive Pacific Coast Conference championships during the time on his time on the varsity squad. Bud will always be known by his competitive nature and his love for the Beavers. He was honored by Oregon State University with the Martin Chaves Lifetime Achievement Award for his support of OSU Athletics. Bud was a community builder. He was a member of Kiwanis, the Elks Farm Bureau, and the YMCA. And Bud was not a passive member. He took a leadership role and project activities. He also took time out of his weekly schedule to work with young elementary students in the Start Making a Reader Today SMART program and participated in the Lunch Buddy Mentoring Program. As Senator Johnson said in her floor speech, Bud was a remarkable asset that every community wishes they could have. Bud's contributions to Tillamook include leadership on the Tillamook County Creamery Board, the Tillamook County Pioneer Museum, Marie Mills Sheltered Workshop, and the Tillamook County YMCA. He also served on many worthy statewide and regional boards, including the OHSU Cancer Research Foundation, but always saw the best qualities in people and in his community. He was quick to support worthy causes, especially those with a benefit to children and families. Right now, at the Tillamook Junior High School, they are finishing up Bud's Community Fitness Trail as a tribute to a man that was a champion in his community. And Bud was a very fit man. So I hope you will support this resolution today and honor this great citizen of Tillamook.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? No. With that, I would accept a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move SCR2 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved SCR2 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion or any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes. Representative Boone, would you like to carry this on the floor? Well, that Representative Boone will be the carrier and close the public hearing and work session on SCR2. Now we go to 10. We go to SCR10. Open a public hearing and a work session. Representative Thatcher, come on down.
And
Senator, sorry. I just still think you're part of the House. Hey.
Once a House member, always a House
member.
Right.
That's right.
Okay, I'm Kim Thatcher, representing Senate District 13, and I'm honored today to bring you SCR 10, honoring Joanne Austin. And she is an Oregonian. I think just it encapsulates her. She's an Oregonian who lived her life in such a way that she has a legacy that has touched the lives of many, not just in Oregon, but all over. And she, I'll also refer you to a letter that's in OLIS from OSU, also in support of this. And she was a business person, a philanthropist, and she served served on many boards and played the role of first woman to do and fill in the blank. And she was just one of those really outstanding ladies, and I'm so honored that she lived in my district, and I just only regret that her life was not honored while she was yet alive. And so I'm hoping you will find a way to pass that today. Thank you.
Fantastic. Any questions? With that, I'd accept a motion.
I'll give you a motion if I can just make a quick
Absolutely.
Thank you for bringing this. I had the privilege of knowing her, and I know her husband. What a great team of business people and philanthropists. I'm sure you're proud of them in your district, and I will be an absolute eye in this appropriate recognition. Oh, and I'm doing the motion. Madam Chair, I move SCR10 to the floor with the be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved SCR10 to the floor with the be adopted recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion passes. We'll have Representative Post be the carrier and close public hearing and work session. Ed Whalen, we have people here for that. With that, I'm going to open up a public hearing and a work session on HCR 32. Aaron, will you describe the measure? I believe we have Bob Livingston, Roger Martin, and Lori Wimmer.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, HCR 2 honors Edward Whalen.
Madam Chair, I'm Roger Martin. I'm here to praise a longtime dear friend of mine, and I have a picture I just passed out. This hangs on the wall of legislative administration. It's a football game between the lobby and the legislature of 50-some years ago, and Ed's on the very right of it. Ed Whalen, and it's probably fitting that a former Republican House leader, me, be here to praise one of the great Democratic state representatives that I've ever known. Ed Whalen was a North Portland legislator back in the days when Portland was divided into five sub-districts, and there were three legislators from North Portland, and Ed was one of them. And he was a great leader. He stood out especially because the other two were the all-time doofuses of the legislature. And by comparison, Ed was just amazing. Ed was born, and he was born and died a Rough Rider from North Portland, labor leader at heart, and a strong Democrat. But he was the kind of guy you would have loved, Madam Chair, to have him in your caucus. And Representative McClain, you would have loved to have had Ed in her caucus because he'd be sitting at your desk talking about let's make a deal. Because Ed Whalen was that kind of guy. He early on aspired to leadership and was elected first to the Portland Firefighters, became the president of the organization in Portland, eventually became the president of the AFL-CIO. He served for 6 years from North Portland in the legislature, was elected at the same time that Vic Attia was elected, and they were lifelong friends and got along. If you read the list of the various offices that Ed held, it was amazing. He was on the Port of Portland. He was on the former Dock Commission of the City of Portland, then on the Port of Portland. He was on the TriMet Board of Directors. He helped TriMet get started to begin with, and in the early 1970s, shortly after TriMet got off the ground, a very serious strike was threatened. And Governor McCaul called upon Ed to go in and sit down with the leader of the Amalgamated Transit Union, and they averted a strike because Ed's premise was, don't have a strike, the public will be very upset. And he was able to settle without deterring what the members of the union were able to get. He worked out an agreement. That was just the way Ed operated. During his last few years, I spent a lot of time with Ed. I became his driver when, after he couldn't drive anymore last fall, his wife died, and you could see a slow downhill at age 89. He didn't have any real purpose to live anymore. I had enjoyable times with him. One of the final days of his life, Gary Bauer, who's the lobbyist for Northwest Natural Gas, and I went to visit him, and he was sleeping about 23 hours a day, but he'd wake up every once in a while and look at us and say, okay, what do you two guys want? And he always had that kind of sense of humor. His friends loved him, and he was very close to both Democrat and Republican politicians in the past. They all had respect for him. If Vic Attia were alive today, he'd be sitting right here urging you to pass this. If Tom McCaul were alive, he'd be here sitting, asking you to do this. If you picked an all-star team of the 1900s, the last part of the 1900s, Ed Whalen would be on the all-star legislative team from Oregon. I recommend you pass it. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Livingston. I represent the Oregon State Firefighters Council, and it's my honor and privilege to be here to support HCR 32 for Brother Ed Whalen, and I say that in the sheerest sense of not in a biological standpoint, but as a fellow firefighter, once you're a firefighter, you're always a brother firefighter, and for his entire life, he embodied what I believe it is to be a firefighter, not only someone willing to sacrifice his own life in the need of others, but he also embodied, I think, what it meant, and I think Mr. Martin did a great job. He always looked out for the person that maybe couldn't speak up for themselves, whether it was that fighting for retirement security, whether it was fighting for fair wages, whether it was trying to find compromise in sometimes a difficult body known as the legislature. Brother Whalen was certainly one that was a pioneer, not only for us, but I think for many that are in this process known as the legislative process. I also had the privilege of working with Ed's son, Tom Whalen, who also unfortunately preceded Ed in death, but he was a fellow firefighter and someone that I actually worked with on an engine company as a fellow Salem firefighter, and Tom also served in this body as the legislature, and a lot of what I learned, while I didn't know Ed, I certainly knew Tom, and there was a lot of Ed and Tom and you know, there's a huge loss and void that is going to be lost by the firefighters in both of those two gentlemen that were truly pioneers. And so with that, Madam Chair, I would just like to really thank Roger Martin for having the thought to bring this forward. And I also want to personally thank you for using one of your priority bills to sponsor this resolution that is not only well-deserving, but one that the firefighters are truly appreciative of, because we have lost one of our true pioneers, but it will be a brother that will never be forgotten by not only myself, but all the firefighters that serve the state every day. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and committee members, for your record, Lori Wimmer representing the family. I was Ed's daughter-in-law, and I'm here to thank you for considering this resolution to commemorate Ed on the eve of his passing. I'm hoping to share a glimpse of the man we knew, bits that don't make it into resumes and obituaries and resolutions. I asked my daughter this morning what she would say about the man who was her step-grandfather. She said, Ed was like an eclair or a loaf of ciabatta bread, tough on the outside and soft on the inside. And I think that probably captures him about as well as anything does. He was stoic and humble and generous, and he had a dry wit and a twinkle in his eye, especially when people confused him with the other Ed Whalen. And though his accomplishments firmly landed him in the history that will be written about Oregon, one wouldn't know that from his very self-deprecating and intensely private demeanor. I won't recount the accomplishments that you've already heard about. Instead, let me share some things that most people don't know about this larger-than-life man. Ed was a personal friend of President John F. Kennedy, but very grumpy and displeased by his brother Robert Kennedy. After Republican Governor Tom McCall appointed this AFL-CIO president to be his first ever director of economic development, you have to understand he was known as the Godfather when he was the AFL president. To be his first ever director of the Economic Development Department, it was Ed Whalen who laid the groundwork to bring Hewlett-Packard to Oregon. As the public affairs manager for PGE, Ed became the president of the Capital Club, for which he was given a silver memento box. That box, along with his political button collection, he gave to me in honor of our shared profession. Some other snapshots. As a young firefighter, Ed was among the first responders to the site at the Vanport flood and had many vivid memories of pulling people out of the water and saving lives. He was the ultimate bipartisan legislator, as you've heard. His many friends to the day he died would attest to that. When his son Tom served in the legislature in 1997, Ed asked him how often the caucus met. When Tom told him, Ed nearly fainted. In the late 50s and early 60s, when Ed served, House caucus members met as many times per session as currently you all do per week. As minority leader, Ed very nearly became speaker. Only a November election outcome stood in his way. When he served in the legislature, there were no Capitol wings. Members' floor desks were their offices, and he and his wife, Phyllis, who was his LA, told me stories about literally sitting at the desk and with scissors and tape, cutting up bills and taping in the amendments instead of doing it as we do it today in a printed form. His wife, by the way, was a descendant of the Aurora colony, and we have a lot of the mementos in the family from the Aurora colony settlers. In those days, Ed told me libations flowed very freely in the House of Representatives. And after taking the cure himself, Ed became an inspirational speaker and a mentor for AA members. When the Oregon Historical Society attempted to get oral histories from him in interviews, he balked. It was only when I reminded him that perhaps his granddaughter, Julia, who is an actress in LA, might appreciate recording of his accomplishments for posterity and for future generations of the family, that he relented. Ed had the heartbreaking misfortune of having to bear the loss of both of his sons and both of his wives. After his first wife of many decades died, Ed contacted a former classmate on whom he'd had a crush in elementary school. He hadn't seen her in decades, of course, but when he called her, she agreed to meet, and within just a few weeks, they became inseparable. He asked me in June of 1997, just 6 months after Phyllis had died, whether it would be wrong to marry Jean so soon. I said to him, Ed, you're old, do it. So 3 days after I married his son, he and Jean went across the river to Stevenson, Washington, to elope because, as he said to me, that's where all the kids elope. Only Tom was allowed to be there because they needed a witness. I know that Ed would be deeply touched that the House of Representatives is considering this concurrent resolution, just as he was when you similarly honored his son in 2013. Though he was truly a modest man and he eschewed the limelight, he also held this institution in its highest esteem. So on behalf of his family, friends, and many admirers, thank you so much for returning the favor.
Yes, Mr. Martin.
Madam Chair, just to add one thing. Julia is his fondest still living relative. She lives in Los Angeles, and she will be here on the 18th or 19th of June. That may be too late to hold us, but at least she'd love to hear people praise her grandfather.
We'll see what we can do with the schedule. Thank you for mentioning that. Any questions or comments? With that, I take a motion.
Madam Chair, I move HCR 32 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved HCR 32 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? With that, motion passes. Close the public hearing and the work session. Representative McLean, do you want to co-carry this with me?
Yes,
we can discuss that after. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that would be good. All right. And with that, I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2668 for the purpose of hearing from a constituent of Representative Wilson's, Courtney Moran. We are not moving this bill today, but we, since you came all the way here, we want to hear what you have to say.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Madam Chair. Just to be clear, I'm not a constituent of Representative Wilson. I am an attorney in Oregon, and I advocate for the genus cannabis. I have a Master of Laws in Environmental Natural Resources Law with an emphasis in industrial hemp law. So thank you all for having me here today and for allowing me to testify.
Then just identify yourself for the record.
Oh, I am Courtney Moran.
Perfect.
Okay. I want to begin by saying Happy Hemp History Week. We are actually in the midst of the 6th annual Hemp History Week. This is a national campaign in celebration of industrial hemp, and it's also an educational campaign to educate the public about the utility and usefulness of the thousands of uses for industrial hemp. So I want to make clear that while my expertise is in industrial hemp and industrial hemp law, and my current efforts are focused around industrial hemp, I do advocate for the genus cannabis. And when I began my law practice, I actually was practicing criminal defense, specifically practicing regarding medical marijuana patient defense. So I do advocate for the genus cannabis, not one particular use, and I just want to make that very clear. My concerns around cannabis particularly stem from the environmental benefits that this extraordinary crop can, it can alleviate a lot of the environmental harms that we are faced with today. It can improve public health, and it can also strengthen our economy. Now, last Wednesday, May 27th, you had a work session, and Representative Wilson made a comment that I concur with, that we need to share the land between hemp, marijuana, and the vineyards, as well as all industry in Josephine County. And I want to echo that not only applies to Josephine County, but that applies to Oregon throughout the entire state. Madam Chair, you also made a comment that we need to consider all of our economic crops, and if they can bring opportunity to our state, it's important. Industrial hemp can do just that. Oregon can become a leader in industrial hemp production and industrial hemp manufacturing. A lot of Oregon counties have been hurt by the decline in the timber industry. If we allow this industrial hemp industry to develop in Oregon, we can put these counties back to work. We can provide our farmers with an alternative rotation crop that it can improve their soils and potentially increase yields on future crops. This will provide a commercial and an economic boom for Oregon, and therefore I oppose the current versions and the proposed amendments to House Bill 2668. Now, I would like to address a few specific points of these amendments that have been proposed so far. So first, I would like to discuss the proposed revocation of licenses. The Department of Agriculture, they did issue the first initial licenses without consideration of a few of the requirements outlined in ORS 571, Section 305, subsection 3, as well as in OAR 603-048-0100, Section 3. I have spoken with Lindsay Ng at the Department of Agriculture, and I've emailed all of you numerous comments on these bills, and in one of these comments I specifically addressed this issue that one of the reasons ODA did not initially require all of these specific requirements, such as the GPS location and the field, the map of the field location, was for reasons of accuracy. That is why licensees are required to follow up within 21 days of planting with the GPS location, a map of the field, which also includes confirmation that they have planted the required 2.5 acres, and that what variety of industrial hemp was planted. Now, with all these issues that have come up in Southern Oregon, you can sort of understand why this happened and why ODA did this. You know, some farmers have been threatened, and they've had to actually move the location of their farms and where they're going to plant industrial hemp. And this mandatory follow-up reporting within 21 days of planting ensures that the Department of Agriculture knows exactly where they planted and exactly what they planted. This industrial hemp inspection field location form is available on the Oregon Department of Agriculture website. Now, while ODA should have followed the administrative rules to a T, their intention and what they are currently doing is staying in contact with the licensees. The Department of Agriculture has followed up with all of the licensees. Everyone who has a license has submitted all of the required information, and any applications that have been submitted since this has been brought to the Department of Agriculture, Department of Agriculture's attention has included all of the requirements within ORS 571.305 and the administrative rules. So there is going to be a new application up on the Department of Agriculture website either today or tomorrow. So this legal pickle, as Representative Buckley has referred to, has been amended and has been resolved. So there is no need to revoke any licenses. Now, I've been told that there is some confusion about whether the Oregon law is in compliance with federal law. Now, let me just take you a little bit through this procedure. Now, back on August 29th of 2013, James Cole, member of the Department of Justice, issued what was referred to as the Cole Memo. This was a memo giving federal prosecutors guidance on how to handle states that have legalized the possession of cannabis. Now, while this memo was specifically targeted to Colorado and Washington, U.S. Attorney Amanda Marshall has stated that this also does apply to industrial hemp, specifically for Oregon. Now, on February 7th of 2014, President Obama signed the Agricultural Act of 2014 into law, which included Section 7606, which provides for industrial hemp research by state departments of agriculture and institutions of higher education. While the law does say specifically institutions of higher education or state departments of agriculture may cultivate industrial hemp for research purposes, what has been allowed, for example, in Kentucky, is that individuals may cultivate industrial hemp through a memorandum of understanding, which means that they are acting as an extension of the Department of Agriculture. So they are also having this federal protection, even though it's not the department itself that is cultivating industrial hemp, but it is individuals out cultivating industrial hemp. So how does this apply in Oregon? Now, although our law does not specifically say research like Kentucky's law does, our law says production, possession, and commerce in. And No matter what type of cultivation is happening here in Oregon this year, it is all research. We don't know exactly what cultivars are going to grow in what type of soil, how much fertilizer we're going to need, are we going to have to use pesticides, how much water are we going to need, what type of irrigation are we going to be using. So everyone that is conducting any sort of cultivation of industrial hemp is conducting research. In December of 2014, President Obama signed the Consolidated and Further Continuing Appropriations Act of 2015, and in that was included Section 539, which says that any funds may not be used in contravention of Section 7606 by the Department of Justice and the DEA. So this means that as long as anyone is within a state operating in compliance with Section 7606, DEA and DOJ do not have funds to prosecute anyone that is in compliance. And just today, about 2.5 hours ago, Congresswoman Bonamici have submitted an amendment that was approved by the House for fiscal year 16, and it's a similar amendment. It will, again, prevent DEA and DOJ from using any resources to prosecute farmers in states that have legalized the cultivation of industrial hemp. So the cultivation that is going to be and is being conducted here in Oregon is in compliance and does have protection on the federal level through different mechanisms, as I just mentioned. Now, getting back specifically to House Bill 2668, This is a bill that's relating to industrial hemp. However, most of the amendments that have been submitted on this bill have only been protecting the medical marijuana industry here in Oregon, and really is an attempt to squash the industrial hemp industry as it's just getting started. Now, last Thursday, Seth Crawford testified, and he said that industrial hemp will be the next biggest industry in Oregon. This is very important for you to keep in mind as you are deciding on your votes for House Bill 2668. Any provisions that are being proposed that would create a moratorium here in Oregon is effectively reinstating prohibition. And reinstating prohibition is sending the wrong message to Oregon farmers. It's sending the wrong message to Oregon voters, the wrong message to the federal government, and the wrong message to the world. Oregon is already 1 year behind Kentucky and Vermont, and we are 2 years behind Colorado. Colorado was the very first state to legalize recreational cannabis, and they do not seem to be having the same issues here. So this makes me ask, what is the true concern regarding cross-pollination? Now, the majority of the talk and the testimony around cross-pollination has been focused on only one aspect of a three-part discussion. And this conversation has been dominated by how can industrial hemp cross-pollinate with marijuana? And while, yes, they are all part of the genus cannabis and they can cross-pollinate, that is only one part of the discussion. So the immediate concern with that medical marijuana growers are having in mostly medical marijuana growers are growing sensimilla marijuana, which is female marijuana. It's basically starved from fertilization so that the flowers will grow larger and have higher THC concentrations. So their immediate concern is having male industrial hemp plants, having their pollen fertilize these female plants and going to seed. And that is their concern about the seed decrease in the economic value of their marijuana. Now, the next part of the conversation is that marijuana can cross-pollinate with industrial hemp. Now, what does this mean? Yes, well, mostly the marijuana out there is all females. Every once in a while, there is a male that is in one of these growers' operations. And if a marijuana male pollen cross-pollinates with female industrial hemp or marijuana, which is high THC, and industrial hemp, which is low THC, would create seeds on the industrial hemp plant, and these seeds are legally allowed in Oregon to be saved. The farmer has the option to. They are not required to. They have the option to save the seed, and also if they have an agricultural hemp production permit, they can retain the seed and sell them the next year. Now, if this marijuana cross-pollinated with the hemp, this seed could have a higher THC yield than the currently authorized 0.3%. So that potential cross-pollination is putting that agricultural hemp seed producer in, you know, a potential conflict with the Oregon law, and they have up to $2,500 per civil penalty per violation. Now, the third part of the conversation, which has not been taking place, is the fact that marijuana cross-pollinates with marijuana. On July 1, we're going to be living in legalized Oregon, and every household is allowed to have four plants as long as they are not in plain view of the public. So if you have a yard, and which happens, you know, either you're out in the country or you have a high fence, you can have these four plants outdoors. Now, not every Oregon household has an experienced cannabis grower, and what if they accidentally planted a male and they didn't catch it in time, and now that male accidentally goes to pollen? Well, that pollen's going to go up in the air, and that pollen from this legal adult use plant could be pollinating any medical marijuana or industrial hemp that's in the area. So there's not only, you know, this risk of cross-pollination between hemp and marijuana, but also between marijuana and marijuana. And if this unexperienced grower did let their plant go to pollen, even not only the medical marijuana growers would have to be concerned about covering their plants, but an industrial hemp farmer would also need to be concerned about covering their plants. So that's what a true cross-pollination concern is, and it's very important that you understand that and what legalization means and what this bill would mean going forward. So a lot of the discussion has been talking about an isolation distance of 5 miles. Now, up in Canada, they legalized industrial hemp back in 1998, and they have a pedigreed seed system where there are different classifications for certified seed, which the top is foundation, the middle is registered seed, and the bottom is certified seed. And the maximum isolation distance that they require for their foundation seed is 5 kilometers. 5 kilometers translates into about 3.1 miles. So what has been proposed, and I have talked to numerous medical marijuana growers and industrial hemp farmers, is a 3.5 mile isolation distance. That's very reasonable. It's beyond what is required in Canada. Canada is very protective of plant breeder and seed breeder rights. We do not have that same laws right now in Oregon, and there is no need for a 5 miles isolation zone when we could be having a 3.5 mile, which is beyond what is even happening in Canada. And Russ Carroll did testify back on February 23rd to the Joint Committee for Implementing Measure 91 that at a minimum you're looking at least a mile, if not 3 miles, isolation distance between a hemp and a marijuana crop. So again, I believe that 3.5 miles is more than reasonable. Now, there is a new proposal that has been recently discussed with the idea that of only allowing female plants outdoors. If we're going to require some sort of isolation distance, for some counties, this would still prohibit industrial hemp completely in those counties. So this proposal to allow female cannabis plants of all species of cannabis outdoors is a great compromise. From my understanding, this has been agreed to by some of the medical marijuana growers in Southern Oregon and some of the industrial hemp farmers in Southern Oregon. And if this proposal to allow only females outdoors without the isolation distance is going to apply statewide rather than in only these three counties, I think it's important that this is discussed with both medical marijuana growers and industrial hemp farmers throughout the state. So my proposal with this is that rather than having, what's been proposed so far in the amendments is to have a mandatory pinning system with this 3.5 mile isolation distance. The Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association has a voluntary pinning system that could be replicated, and the way that their system works is that you do have to pay in. Obviously, this would be mandatory, so that wouldn't be the case, but farmers pay in to be part of this. There is a map. It used to be literally going to a map and pinning out the distances. Now it's an electronic map, and they put out exactly where each crop is and create the isolation. I'm almost done. Put out the isolation distances, and they have had a 100% success rate since the implementation of their regulations in 1980. This is what coexistence looks like. This is what friendly farming looks like. So if you have additional questions about that proposal, I'd be happy to address them. Cannabis can coexist with cannabis. Thank you.
Any questions or comments from the committee? Representative Wilson.
Pardon me if I could ask one question, and that would be about the present crops that are already sown right now.
Yes.
What do you recommend happen there?
I think that they should be allowed to stay in the ground. These farmers have a right under Oregon law to have their crops in the ground, and there is no reason to revoke any licenses or to uproot these crops.
Thank you.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regarding the isolation, despite Canada's standard, what's the problem with another mile and a half, 3.5 to 5?
Why do we need another mile and a half?
But what is the inconvenience or the danger of that?
There is no danger, but it limits the amount of what farms can be placed where. I mean, this whole proposal has been because of the concern in Southern Oregon. And while I do not want any medical marijuana grows to be affected in Southern Oregon, this would mean that there can be no industrial hemp in Southern Oregon. Should we allow one market to control what's happening throughout the entire state?
Follow up. Yes. Just to understand then, in your opinion, for Southern Oregon, going to 5 is a way of eliminating the hemp farms?
Exactly.
Any other questions? Thank you so much for coming, and I'm sorry I mislabeled your constituency, but we do very much appreciate you being here and your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, and with that, I will close the work session on 2668, and I will open up a work session on SCR
9. Erin, will you describe the measure?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, SCR 9 recognizes Portland Winterhawks for 4 consecutive winter conference championships.
Ms. Woon, welcome to the House Rules Committee.
Thank you very much, Chair Hoyle.
Talk about one of my favorite subjects.
Yes. Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, my name is Molly Woon. I live in Portland in House District 43. I'm the communications director for the Senate Majority Office, but I am here in my capacity as a Portland Winterhawks fan. I asked Senator Rosenbaum to introduce this bill, and Alan Fleischman from Representative Barker's office asked his boss to co-sponsor to give the Winterhawks some recognition for this remarkable feat of 4 Western Conference championships in a row, ending in 2014. I was hoping that at this late date in session, I could come here with an amendment and make it 5 in a row, but unfortunately, in May, we lost in the 4th round to Kelowna, and we didn't make it a 5th. But 4 is still pretty cool. The Winterhawks are a great organization. They do a lot for a lot of nonprofit stuff, a lot of stuff to help kids and get kids involved in physical activity and hockey. And they've got quite a list of achievements, all outlined in the resolution. I am particularly happy to be here on the first night of the Stanley Cup Finals. There are 3 former Winterhawks players playing in tonight's game. So I'm feeling pretty impartial. That's it. I encourage your support, and I thank you so much for your time.
Any questions or comments? Nobody? I will say thank you. I grew up playing hockey. It is a fantastic sport. It actually is one of the sports. Yeah. And to be fair, my position was left wing. Not a lie. On the mini Maple Leafs, that is true. But this is a sport where you actually use both your left and your right brain. It's an aerobic sport because you have to pick the trajectory of where the puck goes and notice where the other players are. So it is a great sport, and I think the Winterhawks are underappreciated. They're truly, truly one of the best teams in their league, and we don't ever hear about hockey because they play it during basketball season. And so I want to thank you for bringing this forward, and Representative Rayfield.
This is probably something that should be taken offline. I was just kind of curious about your demeanor on the ice rink. You were talking about using your left and your right side of the brain, that got me engaged.
And elbows.
How aggressive you were. Penalty box.
Representative Rayfield, hockey is a full contact sport, just like politics. I'll leave it at that. With that, I would accept a motion.
Well, Madam Chair, I move SCR 9 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved SCR 9 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, the motion passes. I will carry this on the floor. And with that, close the work session. And with that, we will go to SCR 3. Erin, will you describe the measure?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, SCR 3 recognizes contributions and sacrifices of Peace Corps volunteers from Oregon and throughout the United States.
With that, call up Robert Thornhill and Thomas DeMio. I hope I pronounced your names correctly, and I want to thank you for waiting.
Thank you for permitting me to wait.
Whoever would like to start first, just identify yourself for the record.
My name is Tom DeMeo. I'm a Portland resident and a returned Peace Corps volunteer. I'm the president of the Columbia River Peace Corps Association. We're a 501c3 dedicated to the third goal of Peace Corps, which is bringing the world back home. We serve to both educate the community through schools and other activities, and we also provide number of services to the community through service projects and a modest grants program where we help fund community and international projects. We're made up of Return Peace Corps volunteers representing countries from around the world and all walks of life. And my purpose here today is to support this resolution and to bring to your attention our group.
Thank you, sir.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert Thornhill. I live in Beaverton. I've submitted written testimony. With your permission, I'd like to say a few words in addition to that.
Yes, sir.
A little over half a century has passed since President Kennedy uttered those famous words, "My fellow Americans, that's not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country." Millions of Americans have responded to those words in a variety of ways. Over 220,000 have chosen the path of the Peace Corps. Peace Corps volunteers have gone forth to underdeveloped countries around the world as living examples of the best of America and what America has to offer to improve their lives. Peace Corps volunteers have made a difference for the better in the lives of millions. I saw the good work of Peace Corps volunteers long before I even considered becoming one myself. What I saw motivated me to eventually become a Peace Corps volunteer. I volunteered in 1996 and served 2 years, 96-98, on the faculty of the Latvian Maritime Academy located in Riga, the capital of Latvia. I arrived in Latvia, a newly independent nation, on my 65th birthday. Though older than average for a volunteer, I benefited, as did Latvians, from my Peace Corps service. It permitted me to remain active and to contribute in a significant way to Latvians aspiring to a career in the maritime industry. Today, Latvian merchant mariners, who I helped to train, are operating ocean-going vessels around the world. I urge this committee to approve this resolution. Enacted, it can serve to bring the Peace Corps to the attention of Oregonians as a means by which they may make a difference for the better in the lives of people in developing countries. I'm thinking particularly of older Oregonians, like me, who, after having experienced retirement, may be looking for ways to put a lifetime of work experience to good use. In concluding, thank you for this opportunity to testify before you. Thank you for what you do here in Salem. And I'll be pleased to try to answer any questions you may have.
There are any questions of this panel? Yes, Representative Nose?
Question, Madam Chair. Thank you. It's just a comment that my husband was a Peace Corps volunteer. He served 2 years in Sierra Leone in the late 80s. And you know, I think it probably launched his career directory and changed his life.
Fantastic. Representative Kennemer.
Madam Chair, it was a big honor when Senator Dimbrough asked me to be the chief co-sponsor of the bill. And Peace Corps has made a real difference in the world. And we thank you for your service. It was an interesting experience. I was very inspired by Kennedy's program. And graduating from high school in 64 and college in 68, and was getting ready to go into the Peace Corps when I got into graduate school instead. And so that was my choice. I volunteered for school. It was a pretty good operation, too. But I've always had that feeling in my heart, and I think it's wonderful when we go out and make the world a better place. And thank you.
Never too late.
And, you know... I'm 68. I'm getting there, but maybe not. Yeah.
Yes, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Thornhill, thank you for being here and for relating your chapter in Latvia. But Mr. DeMeo, did I miss your chapter in the Peace Corps? You mentioned you were a returnee.
Yes.
I'd love to know your path.
Sure. Thank you for asking. I was a Peace Corps volunteer for 4 years. I did 2 years in Ghana, West Africa, and then 2 years in Botswana, Southern Africa, and I was a forestry volunteer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Okay, with that, I would accept a motion.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I move.
Three.
I move SCR 3 to the floor with an absolute be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved SCR 3 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? If not, the motion passes. Representative Kennemer, would you like to carry this on the floor?
Very pleased to. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll close the public hearing and work session.
Thank you.
And with that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have no testimony yet.
Okay, we have to hold off on that because I think I'm going to need a recess before we do it.
We don't have that.
Yes. I really want to get that done. All right, where is that? Which one is that?
Good.
Okay, with that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3549. Erin, will you describe the measure?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3549 requires individual engaging in application of pesticides by aircraft to have aerial pesticide applicator certificate. It establishes qualifications for attaining and maintaining certificate. It authorizes the Oregon Department of Agriculture to suspend, revoke, or refuse to renew license, certificate, or other authorization if civil penalty is not paid within 90 days, and it increases the amount of civil penalties. You have a -4 amendment that was adopted by this committee on May 21st. The -4 amendment, which is now included in the measure, removes requirement for State Forestry Department to collect and analyze information regarding sufficiency of existing legal requirements to protect certain areas in proximity to forest land impacts, and establishes a 60-foot buffer zone when applying herbicides by aircraft near inhabited dwelling or school. With the -4 amendment, Madam Chair, you have a no revenue impact, and a fiscal impact statement was issued on the -4 amendment showing both a expenditure and revenue impact to the department. So this measure with that amendment needs to go to Ways and Means.
We have no testimony on this. We heard testimony the other day, but I would accept a motion for the -4 amendments.
Madam Chair,
we've already adopted the -4.
Oh, sorry, I forgot. I would accept a different motion.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3549 with a due pass as amended recommendation, and the measure be referred to Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved House Bill 3549 as amended. Has moved to House Bill 3549 with a due pass as amended recommendation, and the measure be referred to Ways and Means. Is there discussion? Yes, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say that I am glad that we are moving this, and I both hope and believe that this is the first thing that we may be doing on this issue as a legislature, but I hope it will not be the last thing, and I look forward to further the work that's going to get done as part of this turning into more progress on this issue in the future.
Thank you, and I also want to thank everybody that this took a lot of effort to get this bill forward. It is not everything that everyone wanted. It is more than some people wanted, but I think that it is vitally important that we do something before we leave here, and I think this is a really good basis in terms of putting in a system for notification, for putting in a place where people can call if there are issues, put in funding from the industry for more inspectors, for more oversight. I think this is This is a step, and I am looking forward to having this voted out of committee into Ways and Means. And I want to thank my colleagues, specifically Representative Leininger, Representative Witt, Representative Clem, and Representative Buckley and Senator Dembro for all of the work they put into getting us here, and all of the advocates that put many, many hours. So with that, there's a motion.
Any other discussion? Any objection? Motion carries. Close the work session and on 3549. With that, open a work session on Senate Bill 458.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 458 designates February 14th of each year as Oregon Statehood Day. This measure does come to you from the Senate at the request of Senator Brzozinski, who introduced it at the request of a handful of middle school students who could not be here with us today, but we're very eager to see this move forward and go to the floor today.
I would accept a motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 458 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved Senate Bill 458 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right. Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes. In terms of a carrier, I would say Representative Holvey should be the carrier, and close the work session. We'll open up a work session on SCR 11. Will you describe the measure?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, SCR 11 honors Shirley Kimball for her service to the state and commitment to fight against mental illness. This measure does come to you from the Senator Brian Boquist and Representative Jim Widener, who could not be with us today, but we did happen to have Ms. Kimball come to the Senate Rules Committee, and she was quite honored and couldn't come today. But we hope to see her on the floor when we move it there.
Fantastic. So I'd accept a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move SCR 11 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved SCR 11 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, the motion passes. And Representative Widener will be the carrier. We'll close the public hearing and work session on SCR 11. Okay, open up SCR 13, a work session on SCR 13. Senator Gelzer was here to testify on this. Would you, Aaron, will you describe the measure? And Representative, huh?
I'd be happy to speak. I don't know if that's
thank
what
you, Representative Rayfield.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, SCR 13 commends Oregon State University Beavers wrestling team on their exemplary intercollegiate athletic achievements.
Can we boo or hooray or what are we supposed to do?
We
please go on and on.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Take a lot of time.
Yes. By that he meant don't. Representative Rayfield.
Madam Chair, Dan Rayfield, State Representative, District 16. I actually want to talk to you all about hemp today.
Great. Thank you. It's time to do something good for Southern Oregon.
Madam Chair, it could be used to tie up those wrestlers.
Oh, yes.
This is a fantastic bill.
Germaneness?
Germaneness, yes. Germaneness, please.
What about agnosticism?
All right. Germaneness. Representative Rayfield, you have the floor.
Senator Gelzer did, again, in the spirit of compromise, put together a fantastic bill that commemorates Oregon State University once again trying to level the playing field because so often I'm on the other side of the table and we're commemorating the University of Oregon. So this is a fantastic bill, an amazing team, and they've done some tremendous, had some tremendous feats here at Oregon State University. I will keep it brief.
Thank you.
More than willing to entertain questions.
Instead, I'd like to entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I happily move SCR 13 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved SCR 13 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes, Madam Chair. Wendy, I believe we should do this and I'm glad we're going to do this, but the most excellent beaver wrestler in this body sits here on our panel. And I would recommend that he carry.
Is that Phil Barnhart?
Just surprisingly to the left of Phil Barnhart.
This is the only time those words will ever be uttered in this building.
There are no secrets.
So with that...
I beg your pardon, Madam Chair. Actually, in the Revenue Committee, Representative Bentz sits to my left.
Oh, duly noted, corrected. All right, any objections? Seeing none, the motion passes. Carrier, Representative McLean? Representative McLean?
It's your alma mater.
It's your alma mater.
He represents
co-carriers. Co-carrier. Representative McLean?
Next man up.
I am more than happy to carry it if I can use a visual aid, which might include.
Representative Rayfield, you are the carrier, and there will be no visual aids. Close the public hearing in the work session. Let's recess for a couple of open up a work session on Senate Bill 29. Erin, will you describe the measure?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 29 establishes procedures for electing precinct committee persons, requires one PCP for every 250 electors rather than one for every 500 who are registered in precinct, provides that write-in candidate may be eligible for election to precinct committee person's position if there is no other candidate, requires write-in candidate to accept successful write-in candidacy before primary election rather than after the election. This measure was originally heard on April 29th. You do have a -2 amendment. The -2 amendment prohibits person appointed to position of precinct committee person from voting at election of county central committee officers at organizational meeting for first 60 days after selection. You have a no revenue and a no fiscal impact on the amendment, Madam Chair.
With that, I would accept a motion. So I think we'll accept a motion for the amendment and then we'll have discussion.
Madam Chair, I move the -2 amendment to Senate Bill 29.
Vice Chair Smith-Warner has moved the -2 amendment to Senate Bill 29. Is there discussion on the amendment? Yes, Representative
Madam Chair, I'd simply note that this amendment really makes the operation of the reorganization work appropriately. My experience in working with the Central Committee in Lane County is that people who were appointed rather than elected to the Central Committee often are very useful in the process of organizing because of their interest to be belatedly after the election, organizing being several months later. The 60-day rule is a good rule because it prevents the Central Committee from being packed with the particular proponents of particular candidates. So I think that's a good rule, but it's significantly more flexible than the existing rule that we have.
Thank you. Representative Noss.
Why are we removing the gender thing again?
Not part of the amendment.
That's not part of the amendment.
So it's in the
next
so
discussion.
Next, okay. Never mind.
Thank you. Okay, with that, is there any other discussion on the amendment? Let's call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Noakes? Aye.
Representative Rayfield?
Yes.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
No.
Vice Chair Smith Warner?
Aye.
Chair Hoyle?
Aye. That the motion passes and the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 29 to the floor with a do pass as amended recommendation.
Vice Chair Smith Warner has moved the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Nose. So
I forget the exclamation. Why are we removing that gender thing again?
Madam Chair, Representative Nose, it is an issue that has been flagged by legislative council as being unconstitutional. This has been in all of the PCP bills that we have had for the several biennium now.
Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Different topic, if I may. The point of this bill, as I understand it, is to reduce a significant piece of the workload of the clerks while maintaining the PCP elections. The thing that we lose with this bill is the ability of a person who is elected by write-in under the current system to accept that election, even though that person may not even have been aware that he or she was a candidate at the time, because the rule would require under this bill would require that person actually file an application eight or nine, I forget the date, but some period of time before the final votes are counted. That of course is a trade-off for the work that the clerks have to do under the existing rule, which requires them to count a whole lot of write-ins and keep track of them all on a whole lot of different elections because of the way we set up precincts. What I think is useful is that we have heard from the Secretary of State that as we are moving along, we're moving more and more of these kinds of filings to the internet. Already it's possible, and I think all the members here know this, that in fact maybe even required that when you file for election as state representative, you file on the internet using forms that the Secretary of State provides. It's my understanding the Secretary of State plans to do that for these particular write-in declarations, and perhaps at a later time for filing for precinct committee person itself during the regular filing period ending in the middle of March. That being the case, I think some of the objections that I had to this bill are at least ameliorated. They don't end, but they're ameliorated. If the object is to get as many interested people involved in this particular activity as we can, this bill seems to me to be a reasonable compromise between the needs of the clerks to simplify the election process and reduce their costs on the one hand, and the convenience of people who would like to offer themselves as precinct committee people. And with that, I'm prepared to vote yes on the bill to get it to the floor.
Thank you. Yes, Representative McLean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm opposed to the bill for a couple different reasons. One, people often make their first elective effort a PCP position as a write-in, and they make those decisions sometimes at the last minute. I think this cuts off folks from that dynamic, that organic dynamic that occurs when neighborhoods all across Oregon get together and with their ballots and they talk about positions and stuff, and then people look down there and say, well, hey, no one, you know, you seem pretty passionate, you know, neighbor, and you know, gosh, there's no PCP candidate. Why don't we write you in? And there's a cheer from the crowd and write-ins come in. I won my first election that way, Madam Chair. I didn't beat Mickey Mouse, but thankfully he declined, and I was given the position. I became a PCP. So I think this does a disservice. Second of all, this involves party. The Oregon Republican Party is against it. It's doubtful you'll have even one vote for a Republican for this bill. So you have to wonder, Oregon, if this is such a great bill, why does one party oppose it and one party not? You have to wonder, because as we all know, that it's not necessarily a sign that there are shenanigans afoot by the outcome of a vote, but you can certainly have an indication that perhaps one party viewed it one way and another party viewed it another. And since the party that's voting for it holds every presiding officer, holds the governor, has made every appointment in the judiciary in 28 years, Secretary of State's a Democrat, you got to wonder, why is it that they're using their authority right now to run through a bill like this? And so I guess my question to this committee and to Oregonians, why do this if it's so partisan? And finally, I think the interests of the clerks, which have been here a myriad of times talking about finances, looking for ways to cut their expenses, and yet we loaded them up with a motor voter law and expenses there. And it seems disingenuous that motor voter law pass on a partisan basis to cause clerks cost, and then we are looking at all the different ways to, quote, save them money along the path of continued partisanship. So I, for one, urge you to vote it down. And I think we should be this committee should be less concerned about doing their job and instead looking at how you can embrace another party's view of the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rayfield.
When the bill first came to this committee, I looked at it and I actually had a lot of the same feelings that Representative McLean mentioned. The one difference for me, because this deals with precinct committee people rather than elected other elected offices, and so someone can be appointed into the position, and that's what makes me feel more comfortable about this bill and really distinguishes this. I would absolutely no way in any shape or form support this for any other elected office. However, for the precinct committee person, where you can be appointed to that position, because quite frankly, some of these things they may not be aware of, the rules, but once they express that interest through all of the excitement amongst their friends, they could then go to the central committee meeting and be appointed at that point, and eventually after 60 days would get the same benefits and rights as any other person. And so for those reasons, I'll vote yes.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am going to vote no today, too. I think we've done enough to the electoral system with the motor voter plan, and I am still not sold that that is a good way to go. And it just seems like, for one reason or another, we seem to attack tradition in this process. And tradition for tradition's sake is not always the best way to go. But on the other hand, there seems to be no tradition around here that is not susceptible to having holes poked in it anymore. And so I think we've done enough to the electoral system. I just like to leave us well enough alone, back off, and reject this idea. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Anyone else? With that, there is a motion on the table. Would you, Zoe, will you please call the roll?
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Kenemer.
No.
Representative McLean.
No.
Representative Nose.
Aye.
Yes.
Representative Wilson.
No.
Vice Chair Gilliam.
No.
Vice Chair Smith Warner.
Aye.
Chair Hoyle.
Aye. With that, the motion passes. I'll carry it on the floor, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 29. And
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I do not believe we'll be meeting later this week, and starting next week, we will be moving upstairs, probably to Hearing Room E.
Yay!
So new location, and we'll be up there starting next week.
Just so I understand, we'll be moving up with the real committee rooms.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Madam Chair, can we unhinge the doors up there so we have the same noise?
I will bring all the creature comforts of this room with us, Representative.
Oh, don't do that. Don't do that.
Yes. All right. With that, committee is adjourned. Committee is adjourned.
We could have filmed up.